Hello, and welcome to Mondays on Tuesdays podcast. I am your host, Firecrow Silver Knight, where we talk about my project, the company thing, Compare Basic, on and off for the first 5 minutes, and then some more interesting things. Today, the subject is zero or one is none. And what I basically talk about is the idea that if you view something as an all or nothing lens, you're likely going to miss the incremental project directions that will matter. And I'm going to talk a bit about my own frustration in kind of getting through to people about what it is I'm working on and why I feel it's important to start over in the lens that I am. I am not a big fan of phrases like, yeah, the show must go on. My sense of, you know, growing up in the 90s where we had things like, you know, regular school shooting since I was 15, and then, you know, weapons of mass destruction that turned out not to exist. And there hasn't been a whole lot of let's keep the racket going that I found, you know, motivating and appealing. So I've always been kind of a, it's already over, let's rebuild kind of person. But I think even before I went to New York, before I wanted to be a musician and then administrative assistant and then software engineer, I think there's always been an element of, yeah, sure, we can patch the holes in the boat, or we can rock the boat until it, you know, breaks apart and build a better one. So zero or one is none. The concept is pretty simple, pretty interesting. And it's the basic idea that if you are measuring something as a something didn't exist before and now it does, you're probably missing the reality that it goes from, you know, 0 to 1, 0 to 3, down to 0 to 0.2, you know, 0.7, back down to 0.5, 0.9. And interestingly, if you're the creator of something, you oftentimes don't really know exactly where that 0 or 1 number is. People will kind of come to you and say, oh, that's really good, you finally got through to me. And from my perspective, it's always been kind of ambiguous if I was between, you know, 0.9 and 1.2, or I was only at 0.7 and there was like 30% more cool stuff to do that they didn't even feel like they needed. And maybe that's enough to deliver, you know, maybe it's not. Maybe my 1.5 is someone else's 1.0. And so I want to talk about two stories that have been my inspiration when I become an angry man screaming at the sky about how people can't see something that's incomplete. And those two stories are one of my favorite rock bands, Godsmack. Their rise to extreme popularity in the late 90s and just some amazing artistry I've always cherished. Very much a self-starter band. Initially released an album they recorded themselves for $2,600 in 1997 that was then later picked up, remastered, and redistributed through a major label in 1998. And I'll talk a little bit about that, and then I'll also talk about the Dyson vacuum story from James Dyson, which is, I found this an inspirational story. It's also somewhat sad that, you know, it took so much for a pretty clear piece of mechanics. So the update for Compare Basic is that I have a few really interesting working components. The first is an animated menu on the Sinica.org documentation site. And you'll see, you click the X and it, like, you know, goes back and forth between a hamburger. And it's not, I mean, I think it's nice, but it's not super amazing. But what actually is amazing is that this represents a SVG, which is a sort of animated layout concept with embedded JavaScript inside of it, and then a post message interface that was originally designed for iframes. And so even though it's not a big deal component, it actually is a significant prototype for animated behavior on websites. The second thing you'll notice is that the feed page for this blog, Mondays on Tuesdays, looks really nice now. It's XSLT, XML, XSL, and XML is one of those really hated, really, in my opinion, misunderstood technologies. These two things and the progress towards the documentation generation engine are actually significant for a rollout that I'm excited about. I've been thinking a lot about, you know, why the traction of this company has been, you know, so much more difficult than I anticipated. I've been told from the very beginning of this concept that marketing and selling a product is always going to take longer than you think it will. And I've always kind of been like, yeah, but you don't know how cool my products are. They, you know, they catch people's eyes, they sell themselves. And I think that is true, but I think the challenge I'm facing about reaching people with my mission is actually what they were referring to. And it really comes down to that I see the world a certain way, most people don't. And I actually would say that that's true of most people. I think, you know, humans are individualistic enough that, you know, some of our greatest fears is being misunderstood. And I can say that, you know, I have doubled down on my unique strangeness, and maybe the experience of that is a little more true for me. But I do believe that, you know, every human walking this planet is dealing with the concern of their unique perspective being misunderstood. And the reason why I wanted to focus today's podcast around this idea of, you know, zero or one is none, is the idea that when something is presented as like an improvement, comparing it to a completed version is likely the best way to make sure it never sees the light of day. And there's been this joke about things created in garages, or, you know, garage bands that are really popular. And, you know, there's stories about, you know, Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak making the Apple computers in a garage and in a garage and a garage. And there's this like romance of, they're just like in their apartment or whatever, and it's so cool. And I actually hear the opposite side of that, which is the companies that are there to identify innovation really suck at doing that. And the evidence is how many things come from a garage, because there was no actual established company that should be monetizing this technology that was able to see through the concept. And I think that's the idea of waiting for a zero to become a one, to take it seriously, rather than the incremental things. So the Dyson vacuum story with James Dyson is very interesting to me. And my experience was first of all, the first Dyson vacuum that I had was a little handheld, and it just worked so well. And then when I found out that it was centrifugal force, and it was like pulling the particles to the outside, and there's like physics and not like complex computery technology, that was just so refreshing. And I just thought that was so cool. And then I started researching the story of how it came about. And I found two things interesting. Number one, why was this such a hard product to sell? I mean, according to Wikipedia, they have 14,000 employees now, and they make everything from really crazy fans that look like they wouldn't work, yet air comes out of them. I interact with those products mostly in those fancy like things you dip your hands in and out of to dry them. And what I found in my research was that not only was it odd that this was a really hard product to sell, a vacuum that just works better. And the story of like, oh, well, you know, the existing companies were in the bag business and they didn't want a decrease in the sale of their bags. Even if that were true, I imagine there were other players that probably would have wanted to get into the scene. And it's sad that it took so long. And what I have in my research, I have a touchofbusiness.com article on Dyson, and then there's some more detailed information on Wikipedia, but I try not to search Wikipedia too much, even though I love them. But it is, you know, user-edited stuff. And it basically says that he came up with this concept in the 80s, and it wasn't until 1991 that he was able to found Dyson Appliances. And he made the original prototype out of cardboard, and the thing worked. And it wasn't even a concept, like a brand new concept. He actually was upset. He was working on a manufacturing product, and they couldn't ventilate the floor well. And he actually found large-scale ventilation systems for epoxy resin, and then also for sawmills, that used this centrifugal force filtration. And so I think it's doubly interesting that not only did he have a working prototype, there were examples of this technology working in the field in a different size dynamic. But like, This is someone marketing a proven technology that's being used, and the business world is still too crusty to care. That's my frustration with this zero to one concept, or should I say zero or one, not to confuse it with people who've written funny books by that title. And this to me is kind of where I come down to on the idea of why it is that American innovation is kind of like a creature that's going extinct. I was listening to Ed Zitron's one of his recent podcasts in Better Offline that I really like. I love the way he breaks down financial statements. And he brought something to my attention that made a whole lot of sense, which is the idea that the American software industry hasn't really had a lot of big wins in a while. Technically, we, developed the internet from the TCP/IP stack that was originally supposedly created at Bell Labs and then part of the, Berkeley System Design crazy AT&T lawsuits. And they finally had to like replace a bunch of code so that it was in fact free and didn't conflict with AT&T's property. And TCP/IP, I'll go into that, probably in another podcast. It basically glued the internet together. And the thing about this American software industry is that like most of the big players are very old. I mean, you go back to Uber, probably the most recent big win that was cited in the Ed Zitron podcast. It was one of the NVIDIA's not Enron, which I thought was a great series, by the way. And then you go back before that, Airbnb, yeah, I mean, that was a big deal, taking assets that were not being monetized and entering them into the market for money and, whatever. But if you go back before that, almost all of the big players had their establishment in the late 90s. Twitter, which is now X, Meta, formerly Facebook, Google, always Google, Microsoft, always Microsoft. And it's kind of interesting to me to think that with all the money and all the salaries and all the like hullabaloo about innovation, we're basically living in the shadow of tech companies that started 30 years ago. And so what I want to talk just a little bit about is the idea that the American software industry is actually hungry for a massive win. And I think I really think the answer there is to stop thinking about zero and one in terms of what can be a completely big, clever, blockbuster product, and quite literally just improve browsers, improve document software, improve phone call software. And I would love a phone app that kept track of my contacts better. I work in restaurants at times, and they don't really have the ability to configure their ticket system. So we as line cooks, kind of, I don't mostly on the dishwashing station, but when I have a line cook shift, I was kind of like reading like, okay, so is the Korean barbecue sauce on the side, or is that orange color just like there for no reason? And sometimes the labels aren't applied well. And to me, what this means is just that the software is not usable. The call out process for these companies are insane. You have to send a text message to a head chef who's the MOD for the day, who's busy cooking. And so you have these crazy expensive ticket systems that integrate with your payroll schedule and track your time and don't really provide a way for employees to call out sick in an effective way. Like they just drop that feature on the floor. And so I think if the American software industry is going to actually make good on its claim that we are, an innovative people, it's going to have to start solving actual problems. It's going to have to start being something that when you are interviewing for a company, their HR tech software plays an actually functional role in your interview. Maybe it gathers your interview notes. Maybe you have the scheduling for your interview baked into the application process instead of some crazy heavy thing that doesn't have a chance in hell of understanding my resume. I uploaded a PDF and it's just like all mangled. And then it dumps off to a separate calendar app. And then once I'm actually hired, it dumps off to a separate app. And so this obsession with zero being something new, it's got to be new. If it's an existing thing, it doesn't matter. And then one being some massive, clever something, I think that approach of ignoring the incremental 0 to 1, 0 to 3, back to 0 to 2, 0 to 5, it's kind of ignoring this idea that there is only value in trailblazing new ideas. And I believe that most of the underserved value in technology is in setting up shop to do something just like the people next door, but just a little better. And to touch on why this has my attention, the mission of Compare Basic is oftentimes reflected back to me as, I don't know what you're working on. And here's what I'm working on. Better software tools. At this point, the Compare Basic system can duplicate almost everything I have needed across my 15-year career, from programming languages, data structures, database replacement, web templating, socket templating, publishing tools. It's really cool. The next phase is going to be looping in a library called libwebsockets and then hooking up recording interfaces through WebRTC browser sessions and making an actual recording and publishing tool. And then it becomes the email to site platform. So it'll have a few tools that I didn't even need in my career. And then the next thing after this research and development phase is to release all the tools open source so that the community can benefit from that, and then begin building products out of them that have these productivity values, right? I want an email system that helps me organize my day instead of make more noise and more complex things. I eventually want to connect that to my Blue Sky account, possibly a Mastodon account, possibly user comments on the blog publishing page, so that I can have communication interfaces that, you know, allow me to stay in touch instead of, like right now when I check my socials, I'm bouncing through Slack and Blue Sky and LinkedIn and email and all these different things. And so simplifying functional technologies as a monetization of the Seneca system is phase two. Phase three is get products out there that are in fact profitable, productive. We're going to charge real money. We're going to make real money. You know, the whole freemium obsession is basically just a race to the bottom where only large companies that can subsidize their staff have a say in anything. So yeah, we're going to charge real money. And we're going to make real money. We're going to produce data visualization publishing tools that people make money from. And hopefully that means they're, you know, willing to pay the fees that we charge. And while that's happening, the Seneca system will continue to be open source as the sort of contribution to the community. And then as we package products, our service hopefully, you know, makes money. The third phase after that is getting a team that works, and then multiple teams, team after team after team after team. So here's the rough overview schedule. Better software tools, higher quality software products, successful team, successful teams, has an impact on businesses that use our software for productivity. They can make more money, drastically increases employment, shifts the technology conversation to a more pragmatic approach around opacity. I think this makes sense. When people tell me it doesn't make sense, what I wonder is that they are actually communicating that there's not enough evidence that this will happen. It's more of a, I don't accept or I don't believe you, which honestly is fair. I mean, like, this is a big concept. It's a really big concept. And so in order to get past that, I don't accept the reality of what you're working on enough to get excited, because let's be honest, like, if I could increase the quality of software, that's exciting. If I could put a bunch of people back to work and have a positive impact on the economy, that's exciting. The lack of excitement in some of my conversations with people means that those two things have not entered reality for them. So I have retargeted all of my efforts towards the documentation engine, which I'm very excited about. I got some stuff to work. It produces a page of documentation from my notes in the source code. I'm now working on the navigation layers because I want that to be really nice. And all of my efforts are focused on that, you know, get developers into this thing, show them why I have built it a certain way, how the buffer system maps down to the string vector system maps down to the string system, maps down to the parser and the path system, and like all these things that work together really well on top of the memory chapter system. And I want this 0-to-1 concept, the sort of 0 or 1 concept, to just go away. Like, everything's incremental, everything's subjective, it's somewhere in the middle, and the work that I'm doing to make this happen is so similar to the work I used to do working for companies. It's really not the case that as a small business I am somehow fundamentally magically different than the corporate offices I used to walk through. I'm just doing what I consider is a reasonably pragmatically good job. And I believe that the way out of the mess we have in the industry is the same thing. Promote people who have a functional understanding of how software is built, where customer value is, and then just stop with the grifty hyperbole of clever things that don't actually make sense. Like, I'm at the point where I'm not even convinced that companies chasing profits is the problem. I think the problem is actually that they're not chasing profits. They're chasing their own status and imagination-based nonprofits. And now that they're falling out of the sky, it's kind of like, yeah, I'm not sure that was a profit-chasing expedition or just quite simply a bullshit-chasing expedition that has ruined the company. So with that, the idea that a focus on incremental progress and the curiosity of those things, the idea that something as innovative and wonderful as the Dyson vacuum and the Dyson family of products from James Dyson, and the fact that the band Godsmack recorded their own album in 1997, and then it was published by a major label in 1998. These things, though they happened some time ago, they do kind of tell me that when it comes to the people who should be funding and distributing innovation actually doing a good job, I don't really think they're looking at the right people or the right indicators. But I am convinced that focusing on a developer audience will help Compare Basic breakthrough. If you're interested in anything I've mentioned or anything I'm working on, head over to comparebasic.com. And if nothing else, have a read and email me if it does not make sense, because I'm desperately trying to get it to make sense. And feedback from people is the best way to stamp my bias out of this project, because I do fully intend to contribute a lot of code and community interaction. And that's all for this week. I hope you have a wonderful end of the year. New Year's Eve is tomorrow. Can't believe it's the end of 2025. And yeah, that's all for now.